lies that blind. What we're seeing isn't what's really there to be seen. No? Then what is there to be seen? His question triggered vivid memories of my experience with Talia, seeing the darkness in the valley shift with my own perception of that darkness. There are two systems in this plane of existence, he'd said. One bound by polarity, called this world, and one free of polarity, called the kingdom of heaven. Two systems. One bound in fear and control, one flowing with love, in which there is no fear, no darkness, no trouble. In Christi is all. In Christi is in all. If other earth mirrored this world, what were we seeing right now that was bound in fear rather than love? Everything. But none of this would make any sense to my father. It hardly made sense to me. Here in Eden, I certainly wasn't knowing it, experiencing it. We stood quietly for a minute, he lost in thought, I remembering. I'm not trying to undermine your experiences, honey, he finally said. Before she was murdered, he swallowed his emotion, then continued. Miranda wondered if you were actually connecting with a higher consciousness, truth from beyond the world we see. He faced me. But I can only deal with what my mind offers me right now. The shadow of death, I whispered. An eye for an eye. We're blind, that's all. Then the whole world's blind and always has been. There's no changing that today. That's not what you told me when I was blind. You told me to believe that all of what we see in this world is radically limited data coming in through five senses and interpreted by programming in our brains. How many times did you tell me our perception can be recreated so that we see in a whole new way? What if everything we see with these lenses in our heads is only one perception limited by our physical senses? You, of all people, should jump on that. I could see that he wouldn't. I might as well have told him the world was made of marshmallows. We don't have time for that, he said. I can only live by what I do see today, and what I see is that Barth poses a terrible threat to the survival of this valley. End of story. He turned and strode back toward Eden. If that costs me my life, so be it, because I know without a shadow of a doubt that if I don't stop him in 2 days, both you and I will die. That's what Vlad told you? I asked as he walked away. What happens in 2 days? The end. Of what? Of everything. Chapter 26. That exchange formed a terrifying division between myself and my father. We walked through the dark tunnel and returned to the vast basin surrounded by cliffs. I could now deal reasonably well with any threat, I thought. I'd been lost and found, shot and healed, blind and sighted. But the prospect of losing my father threatened me with fresh panic. Heading into the gloomy valley, I recalled Talia's teaching that fear created more fear. Wrath would only create more wrath. Joining the system of problems by offering it outrage would only produce more of the same. Wasn't I doing the same thing by worrying for my father? Who would break out of the system if I couldn't? As we began our descent, it occurred to me that if my father could see what I'd seen in my dreams, he would think very differently about what was happening in Eden. Vlad still had the book, but what if I got it and wrote my father into that reality? The thought swallowed me. I caught up to him and told him that I wanted to be alone and would come home in a while. He objected, strenuously. Barth would be gunning for me as much as him. But I insisted that I would see anyone coming from that high place. He finally agreed and left me. I climbed to a small knoll off the road and sat in my own silence for a few hours, contemplating the sky, the town, Vlad, the seals, Talia, Samuel, Jacob, myself, all of it. Down in the town, which I could see clearly from my vantage point, everything looked peaceful. False sky and empty streets. Eden was what it was. Behind closed doors, Linda was undoubtedly pacing and raging. Maybe she'd snuck out and gone looking for the missing children. Barth was either mapping out his new regime or hunting for dissidents. Maxwell Emerson, the town's financier, was probably still trying to figure out how he'd spent so many years hoarding money that didn't exist. For all I knew, 10 more people had been killed. But from where I was sitting, all appeared to be well. Part of me was desperate to do something, fix it all, find the second seal. But something Talia had said shut that voice down. The teaching will appear when the student is ready. The seal would find me as I surrendered to the journey. I was doing that, right? The seal would come when I was ready. I was doing everything I knew to do, and that afternoon my path was to sit on the knoll overlooking Eden, because nothing else presented itself to me. One thought hit me late, as our false sky darkened. That sky was like scales that had blinded us all to truth for many years. If Eden was a lie, maybe my task was simply to undo the lie, collapse the entire system, escape Eden. But that couldn't be. The charges Vlad had planted would kill us all. Even if they didn't, we'd be exposed to the fallout beyond. I stayed away much longer than I'd planned, so when I returned, I was afraid of what I might find. I approached our house from the woods behind and snuck in unseen. "Dad?" I called out. But the house was empty. He'd left a note on the counter. "Gone to Linda's. Back soon. Keep the door bolted and stay in your room." Linda's? I considered going to Linda's house myself, but quickly let the notion die. Night was coming, and there was nothing I could do without more information. For that, I had to dream. Never mind that I would be waking in a prison. Talia had led me to that prison. I fixed myself some eggs, stripped out of my bloody jeans, showered all the nastiness off, and since my father still hadn't returned, lay down on my bed. It took me 2 hours to fall asleep, and then only with the help of 2 Advil PMs. The cell in Museum City was nearly dark, lit by a single pitch-burning torch at the end of the hall. There were no beds, only the stone floor, one concrete wall and 3 other walls formed by iron bars. Jacob lay with his back to me, snoring softly. How long had I slept? I checked my thigh, smooth and whole. Apparently Jacob had taken the liberty of wiping the blood from my leg. "You're awake?" He twisted, saw me sitting up, and scrambled to his feet. "You're awake, Mother of Tile. I thought someone had stolen your mind." "How long have I been out?"
"The day and half the night. It will be light soon, though we'll never know it in this coffin." "They came."
"Who?"
"One of their overlords, a pompous old crone in a black robe. They called him the prosecutor. It seems they mean to put us on trial at daybreak."
"On what charge?"
certainly heresy. And he was utterly curious of you. He waved a hand in disgust. I'll never understand the way of the albino, so wrapped up in particular beliefs with which you bless or condemn. It's a wonder any sane soul would want to follow a deity bent upon such punishment.
And yet you follow Tile.
Tile? He's a monster who makes no claim to be good. Not a deity who loves with his lips and slays with his hands.
He paused.
We should decide on a defense, or I'll be dead. And you, worse.
What could be worse?
His statement alarmed me.
Why do you say that?
Terrible suffering in life is worse than death. He looked at me with gentle eyes and lowered his voice. As the 49th, you must know that your enemies do not mean to kill you, but force you into a betrayal of all mysticism, all mystics. Me, they would kill unless they see a way to leverage my life. But you... His voice trailed off.
You say this to encourage me?
I demanded. Forgive me. I only mean to help.
So that what? Your Baal can torture me again?
No.
He was quick to respond, and I found surprising comfort in the confidence of his tone.
Never. His eyes shifted to my leg. Your wound?
This, too, gave me comfort. It's healed, I said. Completely.
We remained in silence for a few breaths, considering the wonder of it. Jacob lowered himself to his seat, legs crossed, forearms resting on his knees. They saw your leg. Your recovery will only support their fear of you as a witch.
What about the fruit?
The guard picked it up with tongs and took it in a box, but I managed to keep this from them. He reached under his shirt and pulled out the page, which he'd folded. If a piece of fruit shows such power, what can paper do in your hands?
I took the page from his hand and held it gingerly, half expecting something to happen. Nothing did. I whispered the first seal. Origin is infinite.
Nothing.
So I repeated it. Still nothing.
An incantation?
No, nothing like that. The first seal.
I recited the finger I'd heard on the cliff.
What is known that cannot be named?
How could I know, he asked, if it can't be named?
I wasn't asking you.
You're asking the paper?
No.
Was I? I repeated the question, but to no avail. That went well, Jacob said.
We have to hide it, I said, scrambling to my knees. It can't fall into their hands.
Then it has to be on your person. But even so, they might take your clothing to be burned.
So where?
I looked him over and knew. My hair was too fine to hide a rolled page, but his dreadlocks...
It took me 10 minutes to tightly roll the page and weave it into the thickets of his locks.
Jacob directed me, telling me to be gentle when I jerked too hard. I learned that hair was a source of great pride for the Horde, nearly sacred in some ways. He recalled the first time he'd allowed a woman to weave his hair, a display of trust and affection. Despite their traditions in the matters of intimacy, I reminded myself that handling his hair and feeling his head weren't much different from handling my own. Both of our bodies were simply earthen vessels. Even the stench of his skin was a relative preference, noticed by one of 5 senses, the nose, and interpreted based on cultural programming. I only had to practice metanoia, new thinking. And the first step in new thinking was to practice letting go of old thinking. Reinterpreting what my senses told me,
envisioning him in the brightest light, if for no reason than to see something in a new way. Had Talia known, I would be in a cell with Jacob. I was nearly finished hiding the page before I realized how profoundly the experience had shifted my perception of him. What was once appalling now knelt with his back to me, a powerful warrior who was like a boy when he set his bravado aside. And me? What did he think of the woman behind him whose stench was equally offensive to his programming? Satisfied with my handiwork, I put my hand on his shoulder. For a moment I knelt beside him in silence. This was his earthen vessel, his costume. Could I love this costume? The thought frightened me, and I pulled my hand away. All done. He lifted his hand to the back of his hair.
I didn't know albinos were so adept at weaving hair.
He turned and sat facing me. Whatever you do, don't leave me, I said. His brow arched.
So now you trust me?
Do I have a choice?
You always have a choice, but I have no intention of leaving you, even if I could. It seems our fate is intertwined, like it or not.
I could just barely see his eyes in the darkness. Can I ask you a question, Jacob?
Any woman can ask me any question she likes. Even an albino.
He caught himself.
Not that I agree with Bale. That albinos are diseased demons, mind you. I don't mean it like that.
And yet you serve Bale as commander of all throaters.
Only because I am son of Kurong, and because it wins me favor among the fairer of the sexes.
What are albinos to you, then?
Another race? Who've slaughtered my brothers? This was your question?
No. My question is, why don't you believe in Elion, who created this world?
He shrugged. Nothing I've heard of Elion is any different from what I've heard of Tile. Both demand to be honored on pain of great suffering. Any deity who manipulates with such a threat is best ignored. Thus, I serve neither.
I found his explanation both insightful and hopeful. His only problem was that he didn't know the same Elion I knew.
Now I would ask you a question, he said.
Of course.
What are these seals you speak of?
I thought about it for a second. They're like markers of my own journey beyond fear, I said. To understand, you would need to know the whole story. At least to the extent I know it.
Then tell me. Tell me everything. I must know.
I took a deep breath, leaned back on the bars, and told him everything. Not only about the seals, but about my dreams of Eden, Utah. All of it. More than I had told anyone, including my father and Peter. He listened with rapt attention, asking questions, often so many that I lost track of where I was. Jacob, son of Kurong, might be a celebrated warrior among his people, but to me he quickly became a curious and insightful seeker.
My, my, he said quietly when I'd finished. Your mind makes me dizzy. I can see that I have much to learn.
That would be me. Only I would say unlearn.
He nodded absently. Yes, I can see that. Unlearn, then. I have so much to unlearn from you.
A pause.
This son of Thomas of Hunter, who took you from me?
Samuel, I said.
Yes, Samuel. If your old man...
Talia,
I interrupted. Yes, Talia. If he was right in this mysterious knowing he seems to throw about.
With stunning accuracy.
If he's right, the boy is likely dead by now. You do realize this?
Samuel's a man, and I doubt very much he's easy to kill, as you yourself discovered. Even so, he's albino, neither mystic nor Gnostic. Why would the Elianites see any threat from him?
He's impetuous, and a stranger to Elianites. Their guard is the kind that kills first and asks later.
The gate to the dungeon squealed.
They're here, Jacob said.
Eyes on me.
Be strong. Show no fear. Tell them you know nothing of being the 49th. I said this to save my own life. Blame it on me. You've made no confession yet.
I hadn't considered the option, but I saw his reasoning.
Tell them nothing of being the 49th,
Jacob repeated, putting his hand on mine.
I beg you.
If I must.
You must.
I nodded, and we rose as four court guards approached, boots clacking on the stone floor in cadence. They unlocked the cell and pulled the door wide. We couldn't see their faces because they were wrapped like the ninjas of ancient Earth. The harsh tone of the leader's voice communicated their demeanor well enough.
Dress.
He flung two white robes at us, then a jar of something at Jacob.
Use all of it. The judge will not abide your stench in the courtroom.
We glanced at each other, then retreated to the corners to do as they asked. The scent of a strong perfume filled the room as Jacob wiped their salve over his skin. I could only imagine his humiliation. I stripped out of my tunic and donned the long white robe without a thought of those who stared at my back.
This way.
We were led down the corridor, up a flight of stairs, down a very long hallway, and into a vast, ornately appointed chamber with a golden dome. The room was no fewer than 100 paces across, at least half of which was occupied by a large red pool directly beneath the high ceiling. Thick velvet ropes ran along the perimeter of the pool, which featured a fountain flowing with blood-red water. A large white statue of a rider on a horse stood at the head of the pool. I immediately recognized Justin. The walls of the round hall were layered in gold, trimmed with wide silver bands that were inset with rubies and emeralds. Red and purple drapes, silk, I thought, hung in great swaths from the trim. The chamber was so stunning that I stopped walking, as did Jacob.
Move.
We moved, over a polished floor made of emerald marble. Then up one of two sweeping flights of steps that rose to a second level, across a foyer to a pair of double doors, which were opened by two guards at our approach. If the hall behind us was lavish, the main courtroom in Mausoleum City was extravagant. There were numerous stained glass images of Justin and red pool baptisms, thick red carpets, marble benches, exotic black wooden pews, and a throne at the center of the platform. But none of the room's appointments impressed me. My eyes were glued to the four men on the platform and the seven who sat in what appeared to be a jury box. The throne was occupied by an older man in white who wore a pointed silk crown. The judge, I thought. To his right, by several paces, was a second seated man dressed in what I guessed to be ceremonial battle dress, a black jacket with silver buttons, a red collar, and golden armbands. He was a handsome man with loose curls, his bright eyes trained on Jacob.
Aaron, son of their ruler, Jacob whispered.
Which?
The one with gold bands.
The guard behind Jacob struck his head.
Silence.
The son of Kurong didn't take the slightest notice, eyes fixed on the son of Mausoleum, arch-enemy of all Horde. History was being made on account of me. Two others on the platform were dressed in black robes and stood behind the bench in front of the throne. Their hair was black and slicked back into ponytails. Both had pointed beards and wore heavy chains with the red pool medallions. A circular wood floor lay before the raised platform, and on that floor stood Cyrus, the Gnostic heretic from the cart, now dressed in a white robe like ours. A man I assumed to be the court clerk stood from a desk next to the jurors.
"The accused may approach and stand before Marcium, right arm of Elian."
Marcium, the supreme ruler.
Shoves from behind pushed us down the center aisle past empty pews, where we joined Cyrus on the circular floor.
"I present to this court the three accused of heresy for just judgment on this day of reckoning in the purview of Elian and his son, Justin," the clerk said.
Marcium flipped a nonchalant hand.
"Another day, another heretic. Are we to be overrun by these imbeciles until the sun itself freezes?"
"Your Grace," the clerk seemed surprised, "this is a Gnostic and a beast, and the mystic of which you were informed."
We stood three abreast in our white robes, facing the judge now, fully fixated on us.
"So my son tells me."
Marcium, bushy eyebrow cocked, stared at me.
"A young mystic at that. Anyone might claim to be the 49th.
She refuses to change her confession?"
"She's made no confession as of yet, Your Grace. It's why we're here. No one has yet spoken to her."
"No?
And why not?"
"It is your law, Your Grace, passed only last week, after your third nephew was mistakenly tortured. No one but you may oversee the conviction of heretics."
Marcium glanced at the court officer.
"Yes, yes, that. A good law."
The clerk bowed.
"The truth is for you and you alone to judge, Your Grace."
The ruler slowly pushed himself out of his throne, approached the bench, and peered down at me. I wondered if he might be senile. Either way, he didn't for a moment believe I was the 49th.
"I was under the assumption that the mystic taken was badly wounded. I see no sign of a wound on this woman."
The court officer had no answer.
"Well, are you wounded?"
the ruler asked me.
"No, Your Grace."
One of the men in black, to Mosseum's right, gave a slight blow.
"If it pleases Your Grace, this is part of the evidence I will present in my arguments."
He was the prosecutor then.
"She's lying to me? She hides her wounds?"
"No, Your Grace, but as I said..."
"Yes, yes, evidence. I heard you."
The ruler frowned.
"She doesn't look all that threatening to me."
"It is her diabolical philosophy, not her stature, that threatens our way, Your Grace."
Marcium returned to his throne, sat heavily, and motioned to the man who was to present arguments.
"Very well, Jacob. Present the case and be quick about it. What is that ghastly smell, anyway?"
They looked at each other.
"It's the awful perfume you gave Jacob to wear," I said.
One of the jurors gasped. Evidently I was out of order, but the whole scene struck me as deeply offensive. Not that I wasn't sweating under my robe. I was as nervous as I was offended.
"You will not speak until your defense is to be given,"
the prosecutor snapped, "and to suggest that I wear foul-smelling perfume is a defamation of this court."
"Not you."
I nodded at Jacob.
"This Jacob. Did you not know that the Horde have names as well? Your men made him wear the perfume because they didn't like the way he smelled."
The Gnostic Cyrus gave a short, soft chuckle.
"Silence!"
"Forgive her,"
Jacob began.
"I said silence. Silence! Do heretics not know the meaning of this word?"
the prosecutor named Jacob, glared at us in turn.
You will obey the law of the church's court or find yourselves in hell. Your appointed defender stands to my right. He will offer all known evidence to save you from judgment. I will present and argue the charges. His grace will render a verdict and sentence that will be embraced by the jury. The only time you may speak is if asked to speak. Do you understand?
None of us replied. He accepted our silence as an acknowledgement. Aaron, son of Mosiam, sat still, watching the proceedings with measured curiosity. Of them all, he was the most dangerous, I thought. It wasn't lost on me that the Elianites had borrowed some names and traditions from ancient biblical history. Talia said they based much of their doctrine on ancient holy texts found in the books of history.
"Please, Jacob,"
Mosiam rasped,
"on with it."
"Yes, Your Grace."
The prosecutor looked down at an open book.
"We have here the rare opportunity to please the court by denouncing the heresies of our three great enemies. We begin with the deluded one, who calls himself Gnostic. Step forward."
Cyrus took one pace forward, arms clasped behind his back.
"It is said Gnostics claim that the material world of flesh and substance is evil, and of no consequence. Is this your belief?"
Cyrus cleared his throat.
"That it is evil. Yes."
"Yes, Your Grace."
"Yes, Your Grace."
The prosecutor looked at our appointed defender.
"Need I say more?"
"I would say so. Yes."
Our nameless defender had a soft, high-pitched voice for a man.
"If you insist. It is also said that Gnostics, believing all flesh is evil, claim Justin did not live among us in the flesh. Is this your contention?"
"It is."
"There it is, then," the prosecutor said, waving a hand of dismissal.
"Yes, I would say that is enough,"
our defender said,
"unless he would say something in his own defense."
"Can the word of a heretic be trusted?"
"No."
"Well, then?"
"Still, I think his words would be in order, if only for the record. He hasn't been found guilty yet."
The prosecutor glared at his counterpart, then looked back at the Elianite ruler, who sighed and dipped his head in agreement.
"Very well. Speak, old man."
Again Cyrus cleared his throat.
"In your rush to dismiss knowing Elion beyond the flesh, you deny that the kingdom of heaven is already here, as taught by Justin. Thus you worship the flesh, not Elion."
"Heresy!" the prosecutor cried. "Anyone with two eyes can see that there is no kingdom of heaven here on earth, you fool. We, Justin's chosen bride, are here to usher it in. And when it comes, it will do so with unmistakable signs in the flesh. Among those signs, swords dripping with blood. How dare you suggest this is worship of the flesh?
Furthermore, you elevate the death of the body to have great meaning. Thus you worship death."
"Heresy!"
"You judge a man by his confession, flesh, and by his deeds, flesh, and by his adherence to law in the flesh. You build your edifices and tremble at the lakes, flesh. You wail when your child is ill, flesh. You do not know Elion except in the flesh, through rituals and buildings and confessions of loyalty. You have made Elion in your image of flesh, a father with a beard who paces the sky, wailing with worry and disappointment. And you wait for the kingdom to be ushered in with signs, in the flesh. Thus you worship the flesh."
The courtroom was deadly silent for the space of 5 breaths. Cyrus was half right, I thought. Talia had quoted Yeshua in saying that the kingdom of heaven wasn't coming with signs, but was already among and within us. Also that the death of the body wasn't death, but only a shedding of the temporary earthen vessel. But the Gnostic was also half mistaken. The material world was not evil. Justin had come in the flesh. The old man, like the Elianites, was only following his best convictions, however misguided they were. I wondered if he had a wife or children.
"This is your defense?" the prosecutor demanded, "to insult us all with your lies?"
Cirrus lowered his head.
"I only wish to speak the truth before you take my head."
"Then His Grace, the voice of Justin, will surely send you swiftly to hell."
He faced our defender.
"Will this suffice?"
"I have nothing to add."
"Good."
To Cirrus.
"Step back."
The prosecutor looked at Jacob, who stood on my left. Seated on his throne, Masiam was picking at his mouth with a small ivory toothpick, eyeing me.
"Step forward, Horde,"
the prosecutor snapped. Jacob cast me a side glance and a wink, then stepped up. He was trying to embolden me, but he couldn't hide the sweat on his own brow.
"It has come to the attention of this court that you claim to be the son of the beast Kurong, sworn enemy of all albino. Is this true?"
"I am he,"
Jacob said, dipping his head.
"And you were found protecting a mystic, the greater enemy. To what end?"
Jacob hesitated.
"I was sent by my father as an ambassador to the Elianites. When it became clear that I would die before completing my mission, I said what needed to be said to spare my life. Nothing more."
He was lying on my behalf, as much as his own, determined to persuade them I wasn't the 49th. But I didn't know if I could support that lie. My palms were clammy.
"You're saying it was a fabrication?"
"Made for the sake of both our people."
The prosecutor turned to Aaron, who gave him a slight nod. Back to Jacob.
"It is known that the greatest heresy of all is to refuse bathing in the red pools. The disease I see before me is evidence enough that you have refused. As such, you live in denial of Elion and are subject to death in all ages. Do you deny this charge?"
"I am Horde, if that's what you're asking. And you are right. I cannot serve your deity any more than I can serve Tile."
"And yet not to worship Elion is to worship Tile. Yes?"
"No,"
Jacob said.
"No? What kind of answer is that?"
"It is my answer."
"Do you deny that Justin is one with Elion?"
"I don't know Justin, so I can't say who he is or isn't. I only know what I've heard of him, that he was a loving man who died willingly. I see no more love in this room than I see among my own people. So it would come as a great surprise to me to hear that you serve Justin, who was so loving."
"How dare you blaspheme the name of Justin?"
Masiam thundered, rising from his throne.
"What do you know of love? The law is love. Ridding this world of all demons like you, so followers of Elion can worship him in peace, that is love. Son of Kurong or not, you are Horde, a devil in disguise. It is my calling to rid the world of every last devil."
He'd transformed into a monster before our eyes. His son still showed no emotion.
"Are you so blind to your own heresy?"
Masiam demanded.
Jacob blinked. "Answer me." "I am blind, Your Grace, but only to the difference between Elianites and Horde.
My skin is different, and I don't follow your deity. But in every other respect, I am just a man who loves women and children and all innocent creatures. Why would I seek a life like yours if it is no different or greater than the one our high priest, Baal, offers?
To save your putrid self, you utter moron. Do you not wish to live in eternal bliss?
Not if it looks anything like you. His words sent a chill down my back. Was he so eager to meet his death? Or did Jacob, like Cirrus, already know that there was no way to find mercy in this court? He was only stating his truth plainly. My heart surged.
This is why Elion despises you, Mossium said. You have no...
He motioned wildly with his hands, searching for the right word.
Respect! Respect for Elion! Respect for Justin! Respect for his bride! Only torment awaits your kind.
Perhaps, Jacob said, but now you know that I am not afraid to speak my truth. Is it not wiser to sit and discuss these matters over bread than slaughter each other? Mossium glared at him, but Jacob had stalled his attack with diplomacy. My nerves were taut. Whatever he was or wasn't, Jacob, son of Kurong, was a man of profound honor, seeking both to save me and to bridge the gulf between his people and the Elionites. The ruler straightened his robe with a tug and slouched back in his throne.
Next!
The prosecutor, who had retreated from the bench, stepped up.
Back!
He flipped his hand at Jacob.
To me, forward.
I closed my fingers so they wouldn't shake, and I took one step forward.
Now to the one that matters, Your Grace, the woman who claims to be the 49th mystic.
He tapped his fingertips on the bench, gathering his words.
You have just heard the beast claim that he lied about your identity to save his skin.
He paced to his right.
Is it or is it not true that you were found yesterday by our warriors with a terrible wound in your thigh?
It is true, sire, I said.
And do you have that wound today?
No.
By what means did you come to have no wound?
By the means of a fruit invested with Elion's power. When Jacob applied the juice of that fruit to my wound, I was healed.
Let the record reflect that in saying Jacob, she refers to the Horde by her side.
The prosecutor instructed the clerk,
not me.
Eyes on me.
From the Holy Scriptures, all Elionites know that any power shown of spirit is as likely born of the Shiitake devils as of any benevolent source. Thus, all meddling in the healing arts is dangerous and deemed witchery.
He faced my defender.
Will this suffice for a conviction on the first matter of witchcraft?
I would hear her confession,
the man said.
Very well.
The prosecutor turned his staunch face back to me.
Do you deny meddling in the healing arts?
No.
And do you not fear that doing so might invite evil upon you?
Even their truth-seeking was bound in fear, and that fear began to press in on me as I stood there. Talia would know what to say, but I wasn't with him. A warm breath suddenly filled my lungs, the same breath I'd felt when first facing down Vlad in Eden's sanctuary. And with it, the same comfort I'd felt on the cliff.
What is known that cannot be named?
I didn't know, but fear fell from me like the shedding of a dead skin when I heard the tender whisper. My fingers tingled and my breathing lightened. There in that deep comfort, I spoke the gentle words that came to me next. If I ask my father for bread,
will he give me a stone? If I ask him for a fish, will he give me a snake? No. Then why should I fear deception? Fear only draws to itself that which it fears, and love creates more love. There are only two systems at work, fear and love. You can only serve one master. As for my healing, it was for you more than me. A sign, so that you too might surrender to the only law remaining, the law of grace and love, which knows no fear, because there is no fear of the shadow when you see with love. The words spilled from my lips. The shadow of death gathers to crush this world. Embrace the law of grace and be freed from the law of sin and death that blinds you in this life.
We are Elianites, the prosecutor thundered, cleansed in the red waters of Justin.
And yet you're still bound by fear. Embrace a love that holds no record of wrong, because without it, all of your other confessions and beliefs are nothing. As Paulus wrote,
the writings of Paulus, embraced in ancient times, have been firmly rejected by our council for their repeated claim that man is united with Elion. They are an abomination.
If you don't embrace the love Paulus writes of, you will soon reap a great harvest of suffering brought upon you by yourself.
Behind him, Mosiam's face had paled. He stared at me, and I felt a rush of compassion for him, for all of them, and for myself as well. Only a moment ago, I too had been bound to the world of trouble.
You are precious to me, dear one.
The gentle words washed over me, and I nearly burst into tears. The gratitude that filled me was beyond expression. The prosecutor shoved a finger at me. The only sign in this courtroom is witchery. You are possessed of Tile, the devil of old. The Holy Spirit has filled my heart with its fear in your presence. That fear tells me your doctrine is bound in hell.
Your fear is only a lack of love, I heard myself saying, as is all fear. Do you not know that the spirit of Elion is infinitely complete and cannot fear or suffer loss? Have you not heard that Justin cannot be bothered, much less be threatened, by Tile? If he doesn't fear, why should you? He looked shell-shocked. I felt only peace and gratitude.
Do you not believe that Elion created this world? He asked.
Yes, I do.
And do you not see all the problems in this world?
I do.
Then you know that Elion is terribly disturbed by all those problems. He wrings his hands, terribly disappointed by all that has occurred on his watch. He storms the heavens, vowing to rescue his bride, however filthy she might be. He will crush the serpent, Tile, and torment all who stand in his way. How can he not fear loss or suffer disappointment? He already suffers. Even a child can see that. Are you so blind?
At his mention of blindness, my nerves began to buzz. But I pressed on, only half-hearing Shadow Man's promise to blind me. My father is infinitely complete and cannot feel threatened, I repeated. There is no fear in love. Is my father not perfected in love? He never has, nor ever will. Fear loss, least of all fear the loss of you, his son.
The prosecutor's hands were shaking. If Elion were as you say, there would be no death.
There is no death, only crumbling jars of clay that are temporal and shift in form. Flesh today, dust tomorrow. The struggle called death is finished. You continue your own struggle in vain because you mistake the dust as your true identity.
The man spun
to Massium.
Your Grace, I have more, but I would spare the church court from further blasphemy in your presence. I move that you issue your verdict now. The evidence is far more than needed.
Massium was watching me, jaw firm.
Your Grace.
He eased back in his throne.
Continue.
Your Grace.
Finish what you started.
Yes, Your Grace.
The prosecutor looked back down at his ledger and seemed to be searching for his next point. He finally cleared his throat and looked up at me.
It is further said that mystics believe in the ancient writings of Paulus and Jonin and Petrus, all of which claim that we participate in the divine nature and are already complete, in union with Elion. As I've mentioned, these texts have been shown to be heretical. Do you cling to these writings?
Tell them, dear one. Speak for me.
In Christi is all, I said, and I could see the power of the words wash over them like a breeze.
In Christi is in all. We are the light of the world. The light is divine, so we are divine, not as earthen vessels, but as we truly are. To deny this is blasphemy. Blasphemy blinds us to who we are as the light.
He stared at me, dumbfounded.
I see.
He walked alongside the bench, running his fingers over the surface.
Furthermore, it is said that mystics love the Horde as they love themselves. All Elionites know we cannot love ourselves. In our hearts, we are too wretched to be loved by ourselves. Do you love yourself?
Would I not love what my father loves? Would I not see myself the way Elion sees me? Would I not give my flesh to see the beauty that Justin sees in me? I turned to Jacob, filled with an overwhelming love for him in that moment. The room was still, waiting for my self-incrimination to be confirmed, but none of that concerned me. I was merely looking into Jacob's gray eyes, wide and misted. I didn't see his flaking skin, nor his long, dirty dreadlocks. These were only his earthen vessel, which meant nothing to me in that moment. My throat was swollen.
And would I not love all of Elion's children in the same way he loves me?
Enough!
Massium rose to his feet, glaring.
I will not hear one more word of this blasphemy.
But you must,
I said, drilling him with my stare.
I have been delivered to your court to tell you that I am the 49th mystic, chosen by Justin to bring a great crisis that will divide truth from falsehood and lead all out of fear. Only then will the lion lie down with the lamb.
You deceiver,
Massium hissed.
We are the Lamb of Justin, and we will never yield to the Horde Lion. I sentence a beast, a Gnostic, and a mystic to death by drowning in the Black Pool this very night.
Aaron rose from his seat, nodded to someone at the back of the auditorium, and approached his father. He spoke too softly to be heard by me, but I could hear the doors behind us opening. Several boots stepped into the room. Guards, I assumed. Slowly, like a heavy gathering fog, the ruler's sentence sank into my awareness. Death. I closed my eyes, wondering what I had just done. But I had to say what I'd said. My words had come from beyond me.
It's him, I heard Jacob say quietly. Be strong, little lamb.
When I opened my eyes, I saw that they'd brought a fourth prisoner into the courthouse. One with long brown hair, arms strapped behind his back, watching me as they tugged him to a halt beside the jury box. Samuel of Hunter. My heart skipped a beat.
Aaron stood back from his father, who slowly turned to face their new prisoner. Mosiam shifted his eyes to me and held me in a long stare before facing Samuel once more.
My son tells me that you are Samuel of Hunter, son of the rumored Thomas of Hunter, proselytizer and enemy of the Horde.
Samuel looked past me to Jacob, eyes hard.
Thomas is my father, if that's what you're asking. An albino, who's neither Elionite nor mystic, it is said. You've heard correctly. We are the Circle. And you cross the Great Divide. Why?
Samuel faced the ruler.
To save the 49th Mystic from the Horde, he said. You know this how?
I know what my own intentions are, don't I?
I mean the 49th, you fool. How do you know this Mystic is the one?
Samuel took his time before responding, choosing his words carefully.
Talia, the old man who travels with a lion, told me she was the 49th after I rescued her from the Horde, my sworn enemy.
There could be no more doubt in their minds. Talia had told me that the Elionites held him in disdain. He was a ghost to them, never available for capture. Samuel had made it clear that he was enemy of the Horde, not the Elionites. He'd already spoken to Aaron and was secretly working on a plan to save me, surely. Why Aaron would care, I didn't know.
Mosiam abruptly turned and exited through a door behind his throne.
Return the Gnostic to his cell to await execution.
Aaron ordered,
"Take the other three to my library."
"Sire, the law is clear," the prosecutor objected. "No sentence uttered by the supreme ruler may be countermanded under any..."
"Now, before I sentence you to the same."
Chapter 27.
We stood in Aaron's library, a vast room with hundreds of leather-bound books marked by numbers, not titles. Oil lamps between the tall bookcases supplemented the skylights. Aside from a large desk in the center, a table with six chairs and a couch with burgundy cushions were the only furniture. Four court guards had bound Jacob's and my hands behind our backs and ushered all three of us down a hall and into the room, before taking up position by the door. I was aware of the tension between Jacob and Samuel. Their wary glances spoke clearly enough. But I was still elevated from the flow of words that had come through me, delivered by a power both beyond me and within. It was as if the light Justin had shown me was flowing through my veins, was one with the spirit of truth, and had spoken. We stood by the desk, waiting in an awkward silence. But Samuel wasn't one to wait. He positioned himself between me and Jacob, who stood watching, calm.
"Are you well?"
Samuel whispered, urgent. I looked up into his soft eyes and saw only deep concern. Jacob, no doubt, thought his pursuit of me was foolish, but I found it heroic. The risks he'd taken, however misguided, humbled me. I smiled.
"Is there no stopping you, Samuel? Talia told you to stay."
"How could I stay, knowing this beast was intent on crushing you? Has he touched you, harmed you in any way?"
"You mean Jacob? He's shown me nothing but kindness."
Samuel looked baffled, then angry. He cast Jacob a suspicious glare.
"Don't mistake his trickery for kindness."
"Back to me."
"I beg you, In your state of amnesia, you may forget what scabs